This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for November 2008. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature a few poems and talk about one of the articles in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear poems by Mary Shebist.
You must be a little alive still.
George Sanchez.
This makes more sense than it seems. Works more often than it doesn't. Except when it really doesn't.
And we're going to talk again about politics and poetry, this time with Robert Archambault, who we have here in the office. But first, in the November issue, we've got a portfolio of 12 visual poems. The first time something like this has appeared in the magazine. It's not something we can exactly read on the podcast, huh, Don?
No, we're going to have some trouble even describing them. They're poems you really have to see, so you can pick up this month's issue of the magazine, or you can look on our website and see some of these things. A lot of people think visual poetry is a little bit like George Herbert's Easter Wings, and really, as our guest curator for this section, Jeff Huth, explains, few visual poems these days function the way poems do. And when you see these things, you'll see that some of them do use letters to create patterns, but there's also poems that are created by computer modeling.
Poems created out of cutting pieces out of magazines.
Yeah. Distortions of letters, scraps of text, also some handwritten things, bits of cartoons assembled as jigsaw puzzle kinds of fields.
And Huth tells us that this is really the greatest time for visual poetry because the computer has made the dissemination of it so it's just so freely available, so easy to do. And also the technique has expanded so much because of the computer.
So the portfolio that we have really just hints at the richness and variety of today's visual poetry, but we think you'll find it very different and interesting.
We also have some poems by some big names in this issue, Billy Collins and Philip Levine and an unexpected contributor, Roberto Bolaño.
Roberto Bolaño died in 2003 at the age of 50. He's best known for his novel, The Savage Detectives, about a group of young Mexican poets who call themselves the Visceral Realists.
And now, for the first time, Bolaño's own poetry is being published in English, translated by Laura Healy. And we have several of these in this month. And one that I particularly liked was a love poem called La Francesa. It's too long to read the entirety of it. It's 3 pages long, but the ending is very beautiful. And you get a sense of Bolaño's poems from this poem. He tends to move quickly back and forth between images. There's a phantasmagoric quality sometimes. It's surrealistic, sort of, but it's not a glib surrealism. It's always rooted in something very actual. And this poem is at once beautiful and poignant. He has met this very young woman, and they have a love affair, and it ends like this. She says, a love that wasn't going to last long, but that by dessert would have become unforgettable. He goes on, an unforgettable love beneath the rain, beneath that sky bristling with antennas in which 17th century coffers coexist with the shit of 20th century pigeons, and in the middle all the inextinguishable capacity to inflict pain, undefeated through years, undefeated through loves, unforgettable. Yes, that's what she said, an unforgettable love, and brief, like a hurricane? No, a love brief as the sigh of a guillotined head, the head of a king or Breton count, brief like beauty, absolute beauty, that which contains all the world's majesty and misery, and which is only visible to those who love.
That is some visceral realism. In fact, at the beginning of this poem, he describes her also as an intelligent woman, a beautiful woman, except, he says, when she got depressed and got drunk.
There's a little bit of that savage detective tone to it.
Yeah, and these poems really unwind the way you would expect they might, being written by someone who's known as a novelist. They have a narrative quality to them, and they take their time, but they're alert to details. I don't think too many American poets are capable of the kind of easy length of poems like this. But another one that's in this portfolio is called Visit to the Convalescent. And it goes on for several pages, but it ends like this, where these characters who are in the poem, real people actually, Mario and Dario, are all getting together. They are people who've met many years ago and discuss politics, poetry, everything under the sun. And at the end of this poem, it's all very reflective and looks back uneasily. And even if Mario's voice and Dario's current voice, shrill as a cartoon, fill our adverse air with warmth, I know that in the images we ponder with advanced piety, in the transparent icons of the Mexican passion lie crouching the great warning and the great pardon, that unnameable thing, part of the dream that many years later we will call by various names meaning defeat. the defeat of true poetry, which we write in blood. And semen and sweat, says Dario. And tears, says Mario, though none of us is crying.
It's a beautiful ending, and it. I used to live in Mexico City, so these poems, Bologna was Chilean, but he lived in Mexico for a long time, and the poems really recall scenes of Mexico City, and also the way that poetry is very much in that culture in a way that it's not here.
Sort of. Yeah, there's a very lively connection between poets and, you know, one's personal romance, politics, what's going on in the world, and you get the sense that poetry is alive, even when these poems look back on people who aren't around anymore or the defeat inherent in certain kinds of political developments.
Bologna was a first-time contributor. We also have a couple of other first-time contributors, one of whom is Mary Shebus. She has two poems in this issue, one of which has a very unusual title.
The title has a missing name with a pair of empty brackets around it. We were a little puzzled about how to say this, so we'll let Mary herself do it.
On wanting to tell about a girl eating fish eyes.
It sounds like the title of a surreal poem, but Mary tells us that the poem was motivated by two distinct experiences.
I wrote this shortly after the death of a friend, and right afterwards that night, I had dinner with some friends, and their very young daughter really loved eating fish eyes. We were having grilled fish, whole fish, and she went around to everyone's plate and plucked the eyes out of the fish and ate them gleefully. And so the memory of that beautiful little girl doing this strange activity became really ingrained in my mind with the death of my friend.
This is one of those poems where the title also functions as the first line of the poem. Here's the poem.
On wanting to tell about a girl eating fish eyes. How her loose curls float above each silver fish as she leans in to pluck its eyes. You died just hours ago. Not suddenly, no. You'd been dying so long nothing looked like itself. From your window, fishermen swirled sequins. Fishnets entangled the moon. Now the dark rain looks like dark rain. Only the wine shimmers with candlelight. I refill the glasses and we raise a toast to you as so-and-so's daughter, elfin, jittery as a sparrow, slides into another lap to eat another pair of slippery eyes with her soft fingers, fingers rosier each time for being chewed a little. If only I could go to you, revive you. You must be a little alive still. I'd like to put this girl in your lap. She's almost feverishly warm, and she weighs hardly anything. I want to show you how she relishes each eye, to show you her greed for them. She is placing one on her tongue, bright as a polished coin. What do they taste like? I ask. Twisting in my lap, she leans back sleepily. They taste like eyes, she says.
It seems like it's going to be a surreal kind of poem. And it isn't really, except that it is surreal if you have a kid to imagine your kid eating fish eyes. Usually it's hard to get them to eat things like carrots.
That's right.
Fruit.
This one's perfectly happy eating fish eyes, exactly.
Yeah. So there is something skittish about all this. The collision of two kinds of things that make us uneasy. Somebody's death and eating parts of a creature's body that we ordinarily wouldn't have much of an appetite for.
And they're linked together in a strange way because the person who has died...
He'd been dying so long nothing looked like itself.
And then when she asks the little girl what the eyes taste like...
They taste like eyes, she says.
In some way, the child's freshness and clarity is an antidote to the obscurity of death. And yet it's a similar thing because she says she is placing one on her tongue bright as a polished coin, which recalls... You know, the coin that the dead are given crossing.
Put on their eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fare that you pay to cross over. Well, nothing looks like itself. You'd been dying so long, nothing looked like itself. But fish eyes, it has to be said, look like nothing else but fish eyes.
Yeah.
And what makes us uneasy about them, I guess, is that they are unseeing, though they look like they're looking at us. So it sounds like it is an unlikely combination, but somehow this poet has managed to.
Yeah, well, it's so hard to write an elegy now that's not fraught with the history of the elegy and somehow, you know, really overburdened by that. And this one does have a contemporary convention in that it addresses the dead. You know, there's a lot of letters to the dead. You did this, you did that.
Right, a lot of pronouns in the poem.
Right, but this one, it's so solidly rooted in this one contemporary event, this immediate event, that it avoids all those traps of cliches.
It really does. It actually flips them around a little bit. So instead of really talking about the person who has died, you have this little girl, and it's the girl who's happy and healthy, who's feverishly warm and weighs hardly anything. I mean, those are things you might say about a febrile patient in a hospital bed.
Yeah.
But here it gives us a feeling that there's liveliness and daring left in the world.
Yeah, it's grief and life raveled up together very tautly in this poem.
Yeah.
George Sanchez is also new to the pages of poetry. He says the poem in this issue got its start from a phrase he heard on a classical music station, plaint in a major key.
It describes a viola da gamba composition that is sort of sorrowful and yet in a major key.
That phrase became the title to his poem. The epigraph comes from a few lines of Lao Tzu, the originator of Taoism, that George Sanchez read the next day.
On a bag of tea, and I had just gotten up with my son, and he was closer to three. He's almost four now, and it was a struggle, and as a consequence of hearing those two bits of language and then having a kind of a rough morning with my son, I wrote this poem.
The poem is Plaint in a Major Key. Here's the Lao Tzu epigraph.
Without even leaving one's door, one can know the whole world.
And here's the poem.
The rumble of the night sounds even in the bright daylight of morning. Life blooms amid the 10,000 things, but does not bloom amid the 10,000 things. Shrivel-eyed, I wake up and tend to the one here and now, clamoring to be let out. Down with the gate, out with the boy, to the rooms of life's necessities. First to void, and next to fill. The order is only order which is disorder. The only disorder is the disorder that is order. We usher ourselves, each in our own way, back down the way, for various brushings, combings, other groomings. Each in our own way, we urge the other towards some kind of growth. One to assume, the other to renounce. One to grow larger, the other to grow smaller, thereby growing larger. Words do not work, and when they do not, other words might. This makes more sense than it seems, works more often than it doesn't, except when it really doesn't, and then that disorder creeps back in. In 5 minutes, a different challenge. In 5 hours, a different one. 6 more hours, the one is rubbing eyes, untangled like a dragon, shucked and undone like an oyster. The night slowly rolls a bed, and the words form stories, form sleep, the sleep of the 10,000 things, the sleep that will echo the next day, in the night's rumbling sounds, in the bright light of morning.
This is one of those poems that really illustrates T.S. Eliot's comment that the poet's mind is always forming disparate experiences into new holes, something like that. You know, and here we've got him. He's taking care of his kid, and he reads on a tea bag. This phrase I like very much, that he read it on a tea bag, and he wasn't steeped in this. And you know,
no pun intended.
Yeah, he didn't. Yeah, exactly. He didn't pretend that he was a scholar of it. And I like the way that these seemingly disparate experiences form one thing.
You don't at all get the impression that a poem that starts off with an epigraph from Taoism is going to go in this direction. Although it's striking, actually, when I thought about this, to read that epigraph, which says, without even leaving one's door, one can know the whole world. And in a sense, the door means where we are, where we live. But the door is a portal. The door is the place that actually we go back and forth from. So that gives him a fulcrum for all this, to kind of leave his domestic scene and actually escape a little bit, get away from the gravity of his household without breaking free from it entirely.
Yeah, well, finding poetry in that, I think so many people wrestle with being so busy or being so overwhelmed with the events of their life. How do they find poetry within it? And this poet does a wonderful job of that here.
Yeah, and he has to balance order and disorder. If he's thinking about this Taoist path, there's a kind of order there, but his life around him is full of disorder, the disorder of having a little kid around.
The order is only order, which is disorder. The only disorder is the disorder that is order.
I like the humor in this poem. There's a sly humor. Words do not work, and when they do not...
Other words might. This makes more sense than it seems. Works more often than it doesn't.
Except when it really doesn't.
Yeah.
And then that disorder creeps back in.
And in 5 minutes, the poem says a different challenge. 5 hours, a different one. It's one thing after another. Towards the end of the poem, he says...
The night slowly rolls abed.
You can see him looking forward to a little bit of peace and meditation.
And the words form stories, form sleep. The sleep of the 10,000 things. The sleep that will echo the next day in the night's rumbling sounds. In the bright light of morning.
But what's interesting to me about these ending lines of the poem are that they say the words form stories, form sleep, and that weird almost rhyming of form and form. And you think of sleep being unformed, where you experience stories in an unformed way. This is the sleep of the 10,000 things. And again, at the end of the poem, the sleep will echo the next day.
And it echoes, of course, the first line, the rumble of the night sounds becomes the night's rumbling sounds in the bright light of morning.
Yeah.
It's
a neat trick because it is a plaint in a major key. It isn't a depressed poem. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have any particular phony optimism, but it has the kind of deeply ingrained optimism that is required for all parents in an ideal world.
Yeah, as you know.
As I know.
A few months ago on this program, we spoke with David Orr about his piece in the July issue of the magazine. That piece was called The Politics of Poetry. And in that essay, he asked, why are we so fascinated with the connection between poetry and politics? The ideal answer, he wrote, would take a proper scholar at least two books to outline, and the answer would also be dull.
Robert Archambault is a proper scholar, but he's not dull, and if anybody can do it in one book instead of two, he's a guy. He says he's still a few sabbaticals short of completing it, but for the November issue, he offers up a hypothesis about poets and politics. Robert Archambault is a professor of English at Lake Forest College, just north of Chicago, and he joins us here in the office. Hey, Bob.
Thanks for having me. I want to begin with a disclaimer. I'm not really a proper scholar. You know, I'm kind of I bear the same relation to proper scholars that bird watchers bear to ornithologists, or ornithologists, I think they're called.
No, listen, in this office, you're...
Yeah, you have us fooled completely. <That's right. laughs>
I also can't guarantee that the book is not going to be dull.
Well, one of the questions that you get at in your essay is why almost all contemporary poets skew left on the political spectrum. They tend to identify themselves as liberals. I wonder if you can just say why this is, and maybe where are the Ezra Pounds and T.S. Eliots of our day who is... Many of our listeners will know we're sort of famous conservatives.
I think that question came up in last month's podcast. I think David Orr mentioned Eliot and Pound in this connection.
Yeah.
And I thought about it, and I thought, what's more striking to me is the commonality between Pound and Eliot and a lot of the contemporary poets who think of themselves as political and think of themselves as on the left. What they have in common is a kind of shared skepticism about a utilitarian society, you know, a society that's about advancing your self-interest, doing practical things with practical outcomes. If you're going to be involved in poetry, you're already going to be skeptical about those things. And the politics that Pound and Eliot have in different ways on the right are skeptical of utilitarianism, skeptical of modernity, skeptical of capitalism.
Well, let me ask you something. So if poets here in the U.S. now really don't have any cultural or political authority, how is it that you say that we're part of the – that we're the dominated part of the dominant class? How is this possible?
Sure. I don't have a lot of profound sociological ideas, but I think that's an interesting idea. It's not really mine. It's Pierre Bourdieu, who talks about this, and it's not poets per se, but it's what Richard Florida calls the creative class. These in sociological terms, are people who have a lot of resources. You know, they're not people who are helpless in the world. You know, they're not the wretched of the earth. But the way Bourdieu thinks about it, he says, everyone has a certain amount of total capital. Some of that is economic. Some of that is cultural. You know, the things you know, the intellectual habits that you have and so forth. And the truly dominant part of the dominating class in this view are people who have a lot of capital and the majority composition of it is economic. You know, they're people, they may be sophisticated culturally, but they're really people who own things. But you go one rung down in the dominating class, you've got the professionals, the intellectuals, the teachers, the academics, lawyers, you know, people like this. They do all right, usually, economically. But where their real strength is, where their real capital is in their culture, their education, and so forth.
How does that translate for poets? So you think poets have cultural capital in this country?
Well, poets, as a rule, have more cultural than economic capital. You know, I mean, all this is to speak in very general terms, and I'm sort of dreading getting a lot of email from poets who say, well, I don't – you say that we're part of a dominant class, and I'm completely exploited and an outsider and have no money, and I'm not even in graduate school when I have no money. And there are going to be a lot of cases like that, right? But poets, as a rule, are pretty resourceful people in that they tend to be well-educated. They tend to be in positions where they're able to use critical thought and so forth. A lot of them are, you know, able to publish and have, in their small way, an audience larger than their immediate circle, right? So these are people who are part of, generally, the privileged classes, and they're not part of that for the most part, on the basis of their economic power. They're part of that on the basis of their educational, cultural capital, and so forth. Hmm. But they're in the lower power end of that field, the dominated part of the dominating class.
Well, if the poets are in that educated part of the picture, as David Orr pointed out, a lot of poets who want their poetry to have a political effect, they're basically preaching to the converted.
The first thing I'd want to say is, you know, someone has to preach to the converted, you know.
That's what churches are for, right?
Yeah, sure, you know, and the choir is there not just to sing but to be preached to, right? And, you know, you turn on the TV now, we're in a political season, you talk about rallying the base, you know, that's preaching to the converted, and that's a legitimate and an important thing, you know. I think David Orr's example of a poem that he thought was a good poem and a political poem but that preached to the converted was Robert Hass, right, that Bush's War. Which for me, it's up there with was it Elliot Weinberger's poem, What I Heard About Iraq? I thought those are the two really successful poems about that war. And Orr's argument was, well, the people who are going to read this are just going to have their views affirmed. Although that really is what public intellectuals do. Even pundits, you turn in not to hear what they believe, but to hear what you believe and to feel that you're not alone. You know, so part of it, preaching to the converted, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you couldn't really get through a day as one of the converted or one of the choir without being preached to.
If you didn't fit into that, what are examples of poems that try to do transformational things, poems and poets that aren't interested in that at all and want to throw that over?
Here's where I'll get angry email. I think there's a lot of self-deception. You know, I think a lot of people tell themselves that they are, in that old Gramscian phrase, speaking truth to power. And we look around the room to whom they're reading their poems, they're speaking truth to their friends and a couple of graduate students, you know. I remember this vividly. It was I was at some poetry conference, and Barrett Watton, the poet, was saying exactly that. We must speak truth to power. And I looked around the room, and I thought, we're not really power, you know. So I think a lot of that is how you justify yourself. There are complicated ways that people go about trying to be political as a poet. One guy I mentioned in the piece that's in Poetry is Joshua Clover, you know, who has that interesting and strange book, The Totality for Kids, right? So what he says about the kind of poetry he writes, he quotes Wittgenstein. His famous quote about poetry is that even though it is composed in the language of information, the poem is not used in the language game of giving information. And Clover sort of twists that a bit. And he says an equivalent formulation from the perspective of politics would be, quote, this is Clover, that the poem wishes to confront capital without being used in the language game of capital. And you can tell the kind of left-wingy world that most poets live in there. And the idea there, I think, is that your work will present a kind of language that can't be used in any way, that won't be exchangeable. It won't be a commercial quantity. It'll stand outside of the logic of the marketplace. I guess all poetry does to some extent. And his idea is that that is in some way a resistance to capital, right? And
does it make good poems?
Sometimes. I mean, like any poetic, it can give you interesting things.
Wasn't that Ashbery's idea? In a way, it's an evolution of Ashbery's idea, who wanted to make a poem impregnable to criticism when he started out. He wanted to make poems that critics could not say anything about.
Yeah,
and of course, the irony is, you know, they've said endless things about the poems.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, Ashbery and Clover get this kind of thinking from the same place, because they both know French literature, right? And the sort of real true believer in this sort of unlikely idea that because my poem is formally strange and hard to understand, it is therefore in some sense revolutionary, it's André Breton and the Surrealists. They always thought, we'll produce something that's so unfettered, you know, not bound by decency, not bound by the market or the needs to communicate. We'll do automatic writing. We'll produce something so unfettered and pure that it will be disruptive of all things and be ultimately revolutionary. And the weird point came when they decided, I mean, they took this very literally, and they decided they would hook up with the Communist Party. And the Communist Party never knew what to make of them. I mean, the question to André Breton from one of the party officials was, how is any of this going to help the striking miners in the town of Lens? You know,
and which is what you say. How is this going to help the wretched of the earth?
Yeah, indeed. And how is this, you know, how is, I mean, one understands a guy like Clover wants to say, look, there's more to life than getting and spending, right? And my poem is going to be something that's not part of that world. But you think, does it help the laid off workers in Flint, Michigan? You know, it doesn't have that kind of direct connection.
It's but does any more poetry does? I mean, because you wouldn't say that Bob Haas's poem does, or?
Yeah. And in fact, one of the reasons I wanted to write a book about all this was to understand how such a strange and counterintuitive position came to be prominent in the poetry crowd that I hang out with. You know, it's a big sort of idea informing language poetry, or in England, Cambridge School poetry, the guys around Jeremy Prynne. And it's less something that I believe than something that I want to understand, because it's such a strange place for poetry to have ended up. And the sort of obvious questions, does this do any good, or is it just an exercise for your own conscience, tend not to get answered in any direct way. You know, one of the things I liked about David Orr's piece was he asked the embarrassing question, like, does this accomplish anything? I mean, there are circumstances in which poetry really does connect with large segments of a population. And you mentioned this when you're talking about Bolaño, you know, that poetry seems less of a little curio and more of a public thing in Mexico. And when I was looking into this, there's a guy, Declan Kybert, who studies Irish literature. And he had a great book called Inventing Ireland, sort of a 600-page book. And he points out that it is generally in situations, third world situations, or situations where the vast population feels in some way disenfranchised or shut out from the institutions of the country, that literature most thrives. And you think about it. When Ireland was a colony, they loved their poets, right, in a popular way. In Eastern Europe, before the fall of the Berlin Wall, literature had this sort of aura, this magical status. It was important. People cared. An Iranian colleague of mine was telling me, you know, in Iran, what do you do on the weekends? You go and have a picnic at the tombs of the poets, you know?
Wow.
But the reason for this, is, according to Kybert, and I'm convinced, is if you're in one of those situations, none of the dominant institutions of the country seems to express your values. Either you're colonized, you know, or you're shut out by an oligarchy. So you don't identify with, you know, the school system, or in America, lots of people, not poets, but lots of people identify with the military. You know, the government, the laws, they don't seem to embody your values. But literature seems to do that.
So how come disenfranchised people in our culture don't turn to poetry?
There's more
so
and more
much
of them. We should be having this economic crisis. Should be
this
a
should be a great thing
boom
for poetry.
Well,
yeah.
The answer is to some extent that they do. Identity politics connects up with poetry in a lot of ways.
True.
I mean, I was reading Samuel Greenlee is the guy's name. And he wrote a couple of novels, one of which was made into a film back in the 70s. And I was reading a little booklet of his called Blues for an African Princess. And the thing that struck me was how alien it was to me, in that it was all about speaking to a community. It was all about you know, in the language of his time in sort of the 70s, you know, hey, brothers and sisters, right? Or it would be like, what is that Amiri Baraka poem called Calling All Black People, which is sort of a – sounds like a radio message. Calling all black people, come in, black people, come in, black people, come on in is how it ends. It's an invitation, and it speaks to a community that's not a community defined as poetry readers but as an identity group, right? And so there's a sense there that the poet speaks for a community that doesn't get spoken for elsewhere. Or you think of a lot of people who are interested in, you know, sort of queer poetry, or less so now, but there was that sense of women's poetry. You know, groups that felt unrepresented could feel represented in poetry. You know, my Iranian colleague Ahmad Sadri, brilliant sociologist, said, because he has nothing at stake in poetry, could say to me quite frankly, he said, when you look at a country in which poetry is highly valued outside of a literary community, it's generally a sign of underdevelopment, you know, that it's that it's in some way backward. And I thought, I felt deeply ambivalent about that, but I couldn't argue with him.
Well, that was Robert Archambault. Thank you so much for coming into our office today.
Thank you.
You can read Robert Archambault's piece and everything else you heard on this program in the November issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded and edited by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.